If you're a leader or an aspiring leader in the business of lifelong learning, you're in the right place. I'm Salisa Steele.
And I'm Jeff Cobb. And this is the Leading Learning Podcast.
Hey there. Welcome to episode 166 of the Leading Learning Podcast. This is the second of two episodes in which we're going back to the archives to present some content that we feel is worth another listen. In this case, we're going to replay my conversation with Barbara Oakley, professor of engineering at Oakland University in Rochester, Michigan, author of multiple books, creator of a hugely popular massive open online course, or MOOC, on learning how to learn. Before we revisit the interview with Barb, though, we want to let you know about our sponsor for this episode.
And our sponsor for this episode is Learning Technology Design, or LTD, our annual virtual conference designed specifically for those who work in the business of lifelong learning, continuing education, and professional development. This will be our fourth time offering LTD, and we know from all the feedback we've received that past attendees have found it a unique and highly valuable experience. Registration is open at ltd.tagoras.com. And we're also offering the opportunity to be a patron for the event, an option that may be of interest to companies that serve learning businesses. You can find out about that by going to ltd.tagoras.com/patron. And we'd like to spotlight some of our current patrons, including 360 Factor, Authentic Learning Labs, Avalar, Bench Prep, Comp Partners, Digitel, EventGuard, Ethos CE, Review My LMS, and Web Courseworks. We've highlighted these patrons on the LTD website, and we'll also include links to them in the show notes. And definitely do take the time to find out more about them. These are companies that have demonstrated their commitment to learning businesses by becoming patrons. So we really do encourage you to support them.
And we, of course, also encourage you to register for LTD 2019. But in the meantime, we're going to turn to the interview with Barbara Oakley. By way of teeing that up, I'll say that Barb is truly multi-talented. She's an author, a teacher, a speaker, and, of course, a lifelong learner. Barb and I talked about Learning How to Learn, a MOOC on Coursera that had been taken by about 2 million folks when we talked, and that number is certainly higher at this point. Learning How to Learn is also the title of her latest book, and it's all about practical tips for how to learn better, along with the research and the science that underpin those tips. She and I also talk about her book, Mindshift, which deals with the learning and change that lie behind big shifts in life, things like career changes. We get into the changed learning landscape and the impact of things like artificial intelligence. All really interesting stuff. And Barb is passionate about learning. She talks about creating materials with a heart. Learning new things and career shifts have been part of her personal and professional life. She's fun, she's thoughtful, a great combination.
Barb really does come across as somebody who's very passionate about what she's doing and who just sounds like a great person to know, to be honest. This was a great discussion. It's one of my favorites out of the many we've done, and that's why we're replaying it. So enough for our introduction. Let's cut to the interview with Barbara Oakley.
Hello out there. I'm Salisa Steele, and this is the Leading Learning Podcast. Today, I'm very excited to be joined by Dr. Barbara Oakley. Barb is a professor of engineering at Oakland University in Rochester, Michigan, and a distinguished scholar of global digital learning at McMaster University in Ontario. She's an accomplished speaker, and in fact, when I first reached out to her about this interview, she had to defer a little bit because she was heading into some heavy travel for speaking. She's also the author of many books, including A Mind for Numbers and most recently, Mindshift. And she has a new book coming out in 2018 called Learning How to Learn. And yes, that's the same name as the wildly popular massive open online course that she co-created. That MOOC, Learning How to Learn, has been taken by 2 million students from over 200 countries, and that makes it the most popular course on Coursera and arguably in the world. So, Barb, thanks so much for making time for the Leading Learning Podcast.
Oh, Salisa, it's such a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
And so I condensed all of your work and your many accomplishments down to just a few sentences and seconds. And so I want to start off by giving you the chance to say a little bit more about yourself, about your background and your interests.
Oh, well, I originally was a linguist. I was trained as a Russian linguist in the Army. I had no Slavic background or anything, but I got out of the Army and realized that nobody was pounding on my door to recruit me. So I decided, against all odds, to try and retrain myself to be more technical, even though I'd always hated math and science before. And lo and behold, I am now a professor of engineering. So I'm fascinated by learning, by the neuroscience of learning, and how wildly different disciplines have an underpinning that that is united by how our brain works and learning how our brain works. And so that's been my fascination, and I am fascinated by online learning materials, as you might gather after the surprise of the success of Learning How to Learn and my second MOOC, which is MindShift, both of which I've done with Terence Sanowski, the Francis Crick professor at the Salk Institute. So it's a fun journey, and there's even more fun stuff ahead.
Yes, I have no doubt. And as we've talked about, that Learning How to Learn MOOC has been hugely popular. 2 million people have taken it. And I know that in MindShift, the recent book, you devote a chapter to talking about the MOOC making experience, and you share that it wasn't terribly expensive to make that MOOC. I think you say under $5,000. I know you personally edited a lot of the video. It sounds like you were somewhat surprised by the popularity of the course. So, to what do you ascribe its popularity?
Oh, good question. Well, just by way of background, so I was invited to speak at Harvard, and of course I'm a little bit intimidated. It's Harvard, and I walked in and the room was absolutely packed, standing room only, all around the edges. And I thought, why on earth is there so much interest? And I think, at least in part, it was because this one little course that was made for less than $5,000, mostly in my basement, actually had on the order of the same number of students as all of Harvard's online courses and MOOCs put together, made for millions of dollars with hundreds of people. And so I think that tells you something very important, that if you use innovative new methods for reaching out to learners with practical, well-grounded in research online materials, they go nuts for them. They love them. And so it's sort of my mission now is to help people learn about learning and how to create better online materials, which is really something we're all capable of doing.
Well, yes. I mean, you mentioned in the MOOC making chapter in MindShift that, pretty much anyone nowadays can produce good looking instructional videos. And I know one of the trends that my colleague Jeff Cobb and I here at Tagoras have noted is the rise of what we call the ESME, or the entrepreneurial subject matter expert. And because the tools and technologies have gotten simpler and cheaper, it's easier than ever for subject matter experts, with that entrepreneurial bent, to put out their own educational content. They don't necessarily need an association to help them produce it or even to help them market it. So I'm wondering if, because you clearly are an entrepreneurial subject matter expert yourself, do you have advice for organizations like associations that rely on experts? How can these organizations provide value to experts so that they remain relevant and helpful to those experts?
I think there's several ways to do that, particularly with online learning materials. It's not necessarily obvious to the subject matter expert about how to get those materials out there to the public. And at the same time, really good well-made online materials can be an enhancement for whatever institution is using them. I mean, like a major enhancement. So I think one of the most important things that any institution can provide is a good, easy-to-use framework that a subject matter expert can put their materials easily online with. So for me, I use Coursera. I've been very happy with the platform they provided. In some ways, it was a sort of a turnkey system. So I think there's a growing movement. You know, certain online providers, you know, such as Coursera, are understandably restrictive in who they want to accommodate as far as the institutions they will work with. So what this means is that other institutions can create their own online courses and platforms. For example, the Santa Fe Institute, you know, and of course there's platforms such as Udemy and so forth, where one can put online materials on very easily. But I think that there's a growing need for simple platforms that that institutions can use to easily house and accommodate online experts or subject matter experts. And that could be a big thing that they can do to help make their materials available for everyone. And that enhances both the expert and the institution that's related with that or affiliated with that expert. Mm-hmm.
Right. So definitely the boon to both that expert and to the organization providing that platform. Yeah, Udemy is definitely one of the platforms, you know, we've been tracking. And in some ways, again, it's kind of potentially providing that role that the association can. But I think to your point, you know, if you can really kind of provide a framework and make something as kind of provide a template for subject matter experts to use, that can be really valuable.
Yes. And also, I think an important thing is that any kind of presentations need to be a two-way street. They enhance both the institution and the subject matter expert. And so if the institution develops their own provider facility, their own basic courseware that the experts can put their materials on, it does serve as a way to help enhance that institution itself. And of course, that means that revenues that come in from online materials can go more directly to the institution instead of, you know, some of the cut going to whatever other provider you may also be going through. And I am here to tell you that the revenues that come in from some of these courses can be substantial.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, especially as you get into millions of users and you know, that broad appeal, the massive of the MOOCs there. You know, one of the points that you've made is that we collectively as a society are often not prepared to be learners and that, you know, we're expected to learn things, but we're also expected to know how to learn those things. And so if you think about organizations that provide education and learning, as do most professional and trade associations, how do you think they can help adult learners, those that they serve, become better learners? Is there any specific examples you might have about what that might look like in the context of, you know, a multi-day conference or an online course, for example?
One of the big mistakes I think that we make with relation to learning is that we overlook the most obviously important things to help learners. So, for example, if we're trying to get people to learn better, we might talk about things like deliberate practice, which means sort of focusing on the hard materials, or interleaving, which means alternating different intellectual tools that you might have. But we forget about, you know, like the first thing is learners procrastinate. So how do you get them to be more effective if they're learning online, for example, taking an online course? I think a good thing for institutions to do would be to give a sort of preliminary, learning how to learn is, it has substantive revenues, but at the same time, it's also available for free. Mm. And so, if you have some learners look at these materials, which are free, they'll learn about things like how do you not procrastinate? When you first look at something and you can't figure it out, does that mean you're stupid? Mm-hmm. Of course you say no, but what's going on neuroscientifically that actually proves that you are still quite intelligent? And how can you grapple with that? This course, it just deals really quickly, effectively, and in a humorous way with these kinds of things. So I think introducing learners to basic ideas about learning, that's something that we haven't been used to, just as you say. And we also haven't, can you imagine that most people go through 12 to 16 years of educational institutions and they never get a course on how to learn effectively? Mm-hmm. Learn all this stuff, but we're not going to teach you how to do it.
Right.
So when I'm teaching, for example, probability and statistics for engineers, it's amazing how easy it is to take for granted that students know they should actively solve a problem when they actually don't. They think if they just look at it, magically their little dendritic spines will begin to grow. And of course, that's not true. So I think teaching students about learning, and even in conferences, you can have a keynote of sorts that gives a common way of talking about important aspects of learning, which I don't care what kind of institution or corporation that you're involved with, whether it's we're teaching about animal husbandry, or we're affiliated with Coca-Cola, whatever you've got, learning is a big part of what's going on in that corporation. And so I think that if you have something in your conferences that gives a common vocabulary for important aspects of learning, for example, the idea of chunking, of creating neural networks that are compact, that you can easily draw to mind. All of these kinds of ideas are important, and people just don't know about them. But once they know about them, they're powerful tools. And of course, that's why the MOOC, Learning How to Learn, is so wildly popular.
So I'm hearing at least a couple of ideas. One is that there can just be a real focus on, using some of the materials out there, like the MOOC Learning How to Learn, to make sure that folks understand how to learn. And that could be kind of a, pre-work or a way to set things up, but then also in the context of a learning experience, helping to return to those ideas, to return to that common vocabulary, if you've set it up either in some pre-work or during a keynote, and kind of baking it into all of the education. So I think that's great. It needs to be repeated, as we know. So we need to learn how to learn, and then keep reminding ourselves how to learn how to learn.
And that's exactly right. And I think that's particularly important because everything is changing so rapidly now with artificial intelligence and the inroads it's making on white-collar sorts of jobs. And so the ability to be quick on your feet with learning new ideas it's never been more important. So I think that the more focus you put on smart learning, not just sort of the typical old-fashioned academic approach of, I'm going to teach you about learning, so let's have 2 weeks on history of education, and then 2 more weeks on how babies learn, 2 more weeks on theories of education, all of that kind of thing. People want practical insight, what's going on based on neuroscience And how can you leverage that to learn more quickly now? And we've got that information because research is giving it to us.
Right. That's great. It's a good point in terms of we have so much more information as the field of neuroscience has grown up. We can really see what's happening in the brain. And I think part of what you're starting to talk about here is what MindShift, the your latest book and the new MOOC talk about. And so you define a mind shift as a deep change in life that occurs thanks to learning. And maybe you've begun to hint at it, but I would love to hear you talk a little bit about what led you to focus on deep changes that happen thanks to learning, and with that emphasis on kind of career changes that can happen in life.
I think one of the most important trends in modern society today is the importance and value of having some sort of technical expertise or insight. You don't need to be a super coder or anything like that, but just a little bit of comfort and knowledge of technology and analytical skills can be of real value no matter what career you choose. The thing is, we're in a period of transition, and many individuals have grown up under that idea of follow your passion. And of course, passions develop about what you're good at. And some things are much easier for some people to get good at. So they can end up sort of slotting themselves on the side, as I did, with learning something like Russian, which has a very limited appeal in the job market. So I see this everywhere. The people are retraining themselves, or they're looking longingly at, they want to retrain themselves, but they're not sure they can do it. And so MindShift, the book, and actually the whole MOOC, Learning How to Learn, and the book of Mind for Numbers, is basically to help people realize that not only that can they make big changes and learn something they thought they could never learn, but here's the practical, here's how you do it. And so I think that's just a very, very important and helpful set of tools for people to learn about in today's rapidly changing society.
Yeah, I think that's very true. And I, like you said, I love the very practical focus that you emphasize in all your work around, not so much the theory, but the application of these ideas and how it plays out.
And I know that's right.
And go ahead. I'm sorry if you were going to say something.
Oh, I think that that's an important point, is that people really like the practical aspect, but people are smart and they also love it if you can give them something practical and then say, and here's the neuroscience that says why. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you can tell anybody, yeah, sure, you need lots of sleep, right? That sleep every night is important. Well, they're still going to ignore you and short their sleep if they are running short on deadlines and so forth. But they don't know things like when you go to sleep, your brain cells shrink. And that allows neurotoxins that have developed during the day to be washed away. So that's why you're refreshed when you have a good sleep. But more than that, when you go to sleep, that's when the dendritic spines begin to grow. So if you've learned something during the day and then you go to sleep on it, that's when the neural architecture develops. So the more you learn a bit every day, the stronger your neural architecture. If you just cram, you've got a weak structure of learning and it will rapidly fade away. So when people learn things like this, it means so much more to them than just, oh, you should get a good sleep at night.
No, I think you're right. It might be the, at least in me, the inherent skeptic. You know, I want to know why you tell me to get a good night's sleep or whatever the advice is. So I think you make a good point about you want the advice and you want the research and the data and the science that backs that up.
Yeah, I think so.
And so, you know, one of the themes that I noticed in MindShift is this idea that our past knowledge and experience very often, maybe even always, wind up being helpful in our present, even if our past is very different from our present. And I know you cite many examples, because one of the great things you do in MindShift the book is share different people's stories. So, you know, there's the woman with her online gaming hobby who eventually becomes translates into a full-time job for her managing online community for MOOCs at a university. And then there's the musician turned doctor who can apply those listening skills he learned from music to listening to a patient. So I would love for you to talk a little bit about how the past can be leveraged to support change rather than confining us to continuing the same path that maybe we started down.
Oh, that's such a lovely question that leaves so much room for a lot of different answers. One thing is that, well, someone told me once that they said, whatever you might learn about, you will be surprised that it will come in handy someday. And I thought, now, come on now. And I have been struck over the decades at how often that comes true. I mean, even if I look at things like, you learn Russian, okay, well, when's that going to come in handy if you're, you know, trying to study in math and science? Well, it turns out that my learning Russian actually taught me a very important metacognitive skill about how do you chunk data? How do you create neural structures that you can call on and quickly put into use? And when I took the same sort of learning techniques that they had used at the Defense Language Institute to teach me Russian, and I applied those same techniques to learning math and science, it worked. It that actually was the key to helping me break through and learn effectively in math and science. Was it everything? No. If I'd known then what I know now, I could have been even more effective as a learner. But so often we'll learn, if you learn something well, there's all sorts of ways that it can help you in another area. And this is why it's important, I believe, for us to remain open and flexible in our learning. And what I mean by this is, let's say that your work involves investing, and you want to help investors do really well. So you try to read every book on investing. You're an expert on investing, right? That's your focus. Well, guess what? Every other expert on investing is going to be reading exactly the same books. Mm-hmm. And so it's harder for you to be creative in what you're looking at. And more than that, you can get kind of stuck into what's called Einstellung or functional fixedness, which means that you get used to one way of looking at things and you can't sort of jump out of that and see in fresh ways. So a good way to prevent that from happening is take a little bit of time, doesn't need to be a lot, but just a little bit of your time, and start learning something completely different. I don't care what it is, whether it's Finnish or you're learning about Japanese manga or you name it. Whatever it is, as long as it's really different, what that'll do is that will help build creativity, like flexibility in your thinking, because you're thinking about something very different. But also, through metaphor, you can bring ideas from this other area into your fundamental area and be more creative. This relates to an idea or a theory called neural reuse theory, which is that once you create a certain sort of pattern in your brain involving one skill or one subject area, you can more easily transfer that pattern and use it in a completely different area, and it can work. But you only can do this if you try to do something. Always keep your brain a little fresh by learning something different, something new.
Yeah, I love that idea too, because I think at the broader sort of business strategy level, I mean, it's like if you're doing what everybody else is doing, then you're sort of competing on the same factors. If you're keeping your learning open and flexible, then that's going to, just by virtue of whatever you're learning, bring in different aspects that other competitors wouldn't necessarily be thinking about. So it seems like it's going to certainly lead to the tendency for there to be some distinguishing characteristics of your business or your learning and that you're offering out to emerge. So I really like that idea.
Bingo. I think you've summarized it better than I did.
Well, one of the things that I thought was really a nice move, I certainly appreciated, is at the end of the book Mind Shift, you make a suggestion, maybe even kind of a challenge to readers, that we don't just settle for making our own mind shift, which would be arguably enough of an accomplishment, but that you suggest that we also try to share the beauty and joy of learning with others. And I'm thinking again of associations that are focused on learning, where education and professional development that they offer are such a key part of the value that they exposed to members and others. So I was wondering if you have any thoughts about how such organizations might go about sharing and instilling this idea of learning and mind shifts as joyful, beautiful things in those that they serve.
Another great question. Well, I think, so one thing for me is that I had never at all been involved in anything to do with video or photography before I did the massive open online course. So basically, if you stuck a camera in my hand and pointed me towards where the button was, I could take a picture. That was the long and the short of my expertise. So I, when it came to doing the videos for the MOOC, I just did almost all the editing myself. And part of it was I wasn't part of a massive university organization that was bankrolling all of this. And actually, as I've come to discover, there are major university systems that have put, for example, $2 million into creating, say, 8 MOOCs, and they've had 300 students over a couple of years and then had it fail. And so I've come to realize that creating online materials that have a heart, that aren't just like a typical, we're just putting it out, we're throwing it out there. Here's a montage. Now we have the talking head here, and then we have a couple pictures here. But actually taking account of the fact that editing is this beautiful, creative process that adds so much to the materials, I think it's easy for institutions to forget how creative and beautiful the materials they are putting forth for their learners can be. It's a truly artistic process. And so I think behind it all, you could talk about lots of just sort of, practical things that you could do. But I think underlying, if you have an approach of we're creating beautiful materials that are really going to help people, it turns into something that's different and it's more magical.
Mm, that's great. And I think it's right. It's very clear that your passion for what you share and for this just idea of trying to really improve across the board how people learn, that definitely comes through in the materials that you've put out there, whether in book form or in MOOC form or in other venues. So we'll switch gears a little bit. I'm kind of pick up from you know, what you've been dealing with directly, and I'm just curious to get your take on, you know, in terms of what's going on in learning these days. What excites you the most, and maybe related to that, what topic or phenomenon do you want to learn more about?
Oh, okay. Well, the big project I'm working on now is, I mean, it just absolutely amazes me that there are no good materials for kids out there on how to learn effectively. Mm. So a lot of the ideas that I share are about how to learn effectively are not only like super powerful, but they're easy to understand. They're so simple that kids can understand them easily. And imagine the leveraging effect of, you know, teaching kids when they're 10 years old as opposed to when they're 20 about how you can learn effectively. And that, hey, if you don't like math to start with, guess what? You know, here's some tricks that can help you. It can open great new career doors especially for the disadvantaged. And so, yeah, I think that's a what I'm working on now is developing a curriculum, a book for kids that'll be coming out in, August of 2018, called Learning How to Learn, but also a whole parent teacher workbook, how to use these materials, and of course, a big part of it is humor. Uh-huh. gotta have some fun in there. So there's lots of like fun. There's great neuroscience, but there's also some funny cartoons. And I don't care if you are 55 years old and a CEO of a major corporation, you will learn a lot about learning from these, very simple, but very impactful ideas. So for me, though, now I think working on that is a passion, but also I often teach around the world about how to do effective, truly effective online learning that doesn't just make people continually drag their attention back to the screen, but actually their attention's riveted on the screen because they can't help it. You're doing this bottom-up sort of compelling of attention because it's just so intriguing. I love sharing information about how to create online materials that help do that. And knowing what we know about neuroscience and applying that can help make superb online materials that is, in many cases, far better than what's currently available. We're still in the same era as the 1950s was for computers. That's where we are now in online learning. So I'm determined to do my best to help us all learn more about learning and also learn more about how to better do that online.
Well, that's great. I can't wait for that curriculum to come out, especially the parent and teacher companion part. I've shared some of what I've learned through your materials with my 10-year-old son. The Pomodoro technique is one that he uses now with his homework, especially when it's a topic that he's not necessarily that motivated around.
Yep. That's a good thing. People don't know that when you think about something you'd rather not do, it activates the pain centers of the brain. So the Pomodoro is a great way to get around that.
Well, so next to last question, and this is one that we like to ask all the interviewees who come on, and it focuses on your own personal learning. And so I'd like to know, what is one of the most powerful learning experiences that you've been involved with as an adult since finishing your formal education?
Oh, I think it's learning how to make online materials. You know, it's kind of funny. About 25 years ago, this professor I was taking let's be charitable. He was the worst professor I ever had. He was just awful. And I remember the students in class were kind of sitting around and he'd boxed himself in a corner with some kind of silly derivation where he'd gone off track, and they were talking about television shows. And so I didn't watch television. I was pretty much too busy. And there is kind of a snootiness in academia about we don't watch television. And sure enough, the professor overheard them, and he wheels around and he says, television. He says, I never watch television. And I remember looking at him and going, you know, I think I better start watching television. And so I did. I mean, it was just a little bit. My hubby and I would sit sometimes and watch a show and kind of follow it through and things like that. And what I think that did was that helped kind of build in my subconscious, how do you make great video edited materials? I mean, it wasn't that I was sort of going into video blind. It wasn't like I was some big expert, but there was something that I was gathering through all those years of just a little bit of television watching. And I think it's just funny. You were saying, you were asking about sort of things that you've learned that can come in handy in completely different contexts. Mm-hmm. And that's definitely one of them. But I think video is really the bee's knees as far as there's going to be some great new techniques out there. And I think instructional design and teaching about learning and learning online is where it's all at.
Mm. Well, great. So, last question. If listeners want to know more about you and your work, where would you have them go?
Oh, go to my website, barbaraoakley.com, and you'll see all sorts of information there about anything you might be interested in. You can learn about when I met my husband at the South Pole Station in Antarctica, or working out on Soviet trawlers up in the Bering Sea, where I... as with many sort of Russians, had some great drinking experiences and so forth. So anyway, there's lots there. And I really appreciate you having me on the show. Your questions are so penetrating. It was wonderful to be able to explore these areas with a depth that I'm not usually able to do.
Oh, well, thank you so much for making time, Barb. I really appreciate it. And I really enjoyed the conversation.
Oh, thank you, Salisa.
That wraps up our interview with Barb Oakley. To get show notes for this episode, just go to leadinglearning.com/episode166.
When you check out the show notes, you're going to see various options for subscribing to the podcast. And if you're getting value out of what you hear, we would be truly grateful if you would subscribe, as it helps us to get some data on the impact of what we're doing.
We'd also be grateful in this season of giving if you would take just a minute to give us a rating on iTunes or on whatever service you use to listen to the podcast. For iTunes, just go to leadinglearning.com/iTunes, and that'll put you in the right place. And Salisa and I personally appreciate your rating and review, but more importantly, reviews and ratings play an important role in helping the podcast show up when people search for content on the business of lifelong learning.
And we'd be grateful if you'd check out our sponsor for this episode, Learning Technology Design at ltd.tagoras.com. Again, this is our annual virtual conference, and if you, like most of our Leading Learning listeners, work in the business of lifelong learning, continuing education, and professional development, it is an event not to be missed.
And finally, please do consider telling others about the podcast. You can send out a tweet by going to leadinglearning.com/share. You can also like us on Facebook at facebook.com/leadinglifelonglearning, and you can share us with others there. However you do it, please do help share the good word about Leading Learning.
This is our last episode of 2018, but we'll be back with an original episode on January 1st. So we just want to pause here at year end to say thank you for listening. We wish you and yours a happy holiday. Thanks again, and see you next time on the Leading Learning Podcast.